second district covers 28 counties, including, you know, Carver, Wright, and Scott counties, or Chanhassen, Chaska, Shakopee, Prior Lake, Monticello, Buffalo, St. Michael, Ubberville, and everything west to South Dakota and south to Iowa. It, about a third of it, you might call as sort of the bedroom communities of the Twin Cities, and about two-thirds of the population is wonderful rural communities like Wilmer, Marshall, Worthington, Fairmont, New Ulm, St. Peter.
Does that present a challenge for you, and does the fact that that there's more bedroom communities and sprawl is kind of pushing out, does that change the kind of political demographic of that district at all?
Not really, because they're all small towns. They're all communities where you can drive up and park beside where you're going without having to get into a parking ramp. I have really strong ties to both sides of the district. I was born in Benson. I grew up in Murdoch, a town of about 280 on the western side of the district. Never lived in a town of more than 1,000 until I graduated from college. And I now live on 60 acres just north of Watertown with my wife of 20 years, our four wonderful children, my daughter's horse, 4-H sheep, and a herd of cats. So I obviously understand the rural side. And having been in business for the last 20 years, I really understand the more bedroom communities part of the district as well. So I feel a strong attachment to both. I think both sides have a common sense conservative perspective on the world. There are different issues. The eastern side of the district is struggling with too much growth. And how you keep the schools up and keep the roads up. The western side of the district is dealing with population declines in some cases, particularly when it comes to school age population. You know, not enough children to really fund their schools in the way that they've historically been funded.
What do you do, Mark?
What do I do? I've been in business for the last 20 years. The last 5 years, I was chief financial officer of a local giftware company here. Called Department 56. Prior to that, I was chief financial officer of Shopko Stores, which has stores throughout the district, and I helped them rebuild two new stores in Marshall and in downtown Hutchinson. So I've been a businessman for the last 20 years and bring that perspective to the campaign.
Let's talk about some of the issues. What do you see as the most important one in the second district right now?
Well, I think the most important issue in the second district is the marriage penalty. That makes the average couple pay $1,400 more just for being married. And I think some of the toughest problems we face as a society are solved by stronger families, so I don't understand why we would tax marriage. That's a key contrast between myself and my opponent. My opponent has voted repeatedly against the death tax, the marriage penalty elimination. I would eliminate the marriage penalty.
You mentioned also the death tax, and that kind of follows up on that and the nature of taxes and spending and that sort of thing. What's your position on the inheritance tax?
Well, I think the death tax makes it very hard to pass on the family business, the family farm, to the next generation. And it also makes it hard for parents to use their lifetime of savings to let their children have a head start in life. It's a very oppressive tax. And it's something that we should reduce and lift that burden from families throughout southwest Minnesota. It makes about a third of those inheriting the family farm sell to a larger operator just to pay the capital gains and death tax that results. And I think we need those farms farmed by those families and not by big corporate farms. I am for reducing the death tax. My opponent, David Mingy, has voted repeatedly against reducing the death tax.
I'm assuming the future of the family farm is also a big issue in the second district, and aside from what you just mentioned and how you can alleviate some of those problems by way of the death tax, what are your other positions regarding an initiative in that area?
Well, I would work very strongly on growing demand, whether it be opening up foreign markets, and at Pillsbury, I help Pillsbury expand in foreign markets, and I'm looking to do the same for our farmers. We're going to be going around the district here in another week or so, collecting grain from farmers that my campaign and a charity are going to ship to a country that we currently have sanctions against, because we're only hurting the common everyday people of those countries when we have sanctions against them and our farmers, and not the dictators. You haven't seen any starving dictators. So doing that, also helping grow value-added farmer-owned production. Value-added production around the district, and I'm going to use my business skills, the same types of business skills that I've used in the last 20 years, to help those farmer-owned cooperatives grow, because the best way long-term to increase prices is to grow demand, and that'll be the focus that I'll have. I only got a red ribbon at the state fair with my Hereford heifer when I was 12. So if someone's looking for somebody who can help them give them get a purple ribbon on their cow, it's not me. But I do have the experience to deal with the business issues that face farming and agriculture, like increasing prices, opening up foreign markets, giving farmers better risk management tools to manage the inherent risk in farming, and also deal with the oppressive regulations that we're now putting on them.
If you're elected, Social Security and the future of it is certainly an issue that'll come before you. I'm sure you're familiar with the various stances on what to do, either to save Social Security or give people the opportunity to contribute on their own to a semi-privatized system. What's your position?
Well, if I ran the pension plan at any of the companies that I've worked for, like the government-run Social Security, they would have thrown me in jail. And I think we need to hold the government to the same degree of accountability that we're holding companies to. I have managed the pension investments for a Fortune 100 company, and I do bring a lot of experience to this, my number one priority of making sure that Social Security is there not just for today's retirees or for my generation, but also for my children's generation. That includes making sure that we keep Social Security Trust off limits to the big spenders. It includes preserving the benefits for those at or near retirement, the disabled and survivors, but it also does include allowing younger workers the opportunity to voluntarily invest and create wealth and grow their retirement assets.
What about dealing with the surplus, assuming there is one, do we use it to repay the national debt? Do we use it for a combination of that and providing tax cuts, or do we just provide it tax cuts? Where do you come on that?
Well, I think my number one priority, as I talked about, is strengthening Social Security. And that not only is going to take all the Social Security surplus that we need to set aside, but also we're going to need to likely invest part of our non-Social Security surplus to put that on more sound footing for our younger workers and keep our benefits for our existing seniors. But we also need to reform Medicare, which is also looking to run out of funds here in the not-too-distant future, and is designed in a way that we only get about half of the Medicare reimbursements here in the Midwest that they get in the coast, because you know, whenever you have a system that's highly regulated and decided by a group of accountants deciding every reimbursement for every hospital, of every procedure in the country, the reimbursements are tilted to where the votes are on the coast. I think we need to reform that. That's, again, a priority. And when you do both of that and set Social Security aside, you are on a path to paying down debt into the public debt by 2013. So those are priorities of mine. But I'm convinced that the two taxes that I talked about that I think are the most unjust, eliminating the marriage penalty and reducing the capital gains and death tax so that farmers and business people and parents can help pass on their next generation, are taxes that we should address and take a small fraction of the overall surplus.
On the subject of health insurance, I'm sure you've seen this issue framed pretty well by the current debate for U.S. Senate in Minnesota. Where are you on that?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to end these Medicare disparities that I talked about that threaten particularly the rural hospitals, you know, their very survival. The hospital I was born in, Benson, is alive today only because we're subsidizing with real estate tax dollars from residents, and it keeps our suburban hospitals and urban hospitals from offering the same level of services that they are being offered in other areas. Some areas already have prescription drug benefits for their seniors. We need to make sure we can here. I think health care coverage without prescription drug coverage is not health care coverage, so we have to make sure that is offered. But we need to do it in a way that offers consumers choice. We also need to make sure that prescription drugs, that we shouldn't have to drive to Canada to get our prescription drugs at those prices, that we should allow free importation of any FDA-approved drug back into the country at whatever price they're selling it in Canada, so that we can offer our seniors the same prices for their pharmaceuticals that Canada's getting here in their own pharmacies.
is that would that be linked to an employer mandate at all, or is that merely a matter of getting Medicare squared away and the health insurance program squared away?
I think employer mandate is not the direction we want to go. We put enough mandates on our employers, and what happens is that somebody who has a very generous plan from their employer, we're heavily subsidizing as taxpayers because we're not that benefit to them is not taxable. But if you're a self-employed person, as increasingly a larger percentage of our people are, you don't get health care benefits that get the same tax benefits that we get as employees. You know, one of the things that I'm for, just as a step in that direction, is allowing full deductibility for health insurance if you're self-employed. That's something that my opponent, David Menge, has voted repeatedly against, that I would be for. But we need to go along a path to make sure that those that are self-employed are getting the same benefits as those that are employed, and having an overemphasis on employer mandates as opposed to making sure that people own their own insurance policy, that they get to choose their own doctor, choose their own plan, and choose their own coverages. That's the approach. That is the only real way that you can balance having quality health care with the increasing cost of health care, by reengaging the individual consumer.
On the subject of education, what's your general philosophy about the roles of the federal government, state governments, local school boards, that sort of thing?
Well, I would say that there are over 740 programs, education programs at the federal government, and most of those you need to apply to by grant to receive. That requires somebody in each and every school district, you know, throughout Southwest Minnesota and the country, knowing what those 740 programs are, applying for them, and then a whole bigger group of people in D.C. reviewing all those applications and deciding who they're getting. None of the people involved in that process are really advancing the education of the children in the classroom. What we need to do is we need to block grant more of those funds. My opponent, David Menge, has repeatedly voted against block granting. I would support block granting in putting more dollars and decisions back in the classroom and as close to the student and the teacher as possible.
Let me throw a couple more issues at you, Mr. Kennedy. Campaign finance reform. Should soft money loopholes be closed? Should we just kind of leave things the way we are? Should we push for publicly financed campaigns? What do you think?
I think what we ought to do in campaign finance reform is empower the individual voter. Because what we need to do is we need to try to make sure that campaigns are to the greatest extent possible funded by individuals. And I would support a proposal that would say you can't spend more of your own money, like we have with Mark Dayton, or more of what you get from special interest groups than you're receiving from individuals. You know, I've received over 80% of the funds that I've gotten in the campaign from individuals, whereas my opponent, David Menge, has gotten 60% of his funds from special interest groups, many of which have interests contrary to the Second District.
And on the subject of gun control, what's your position?
Well, I think we really need to enforce our gun laws so that those that commit crimes with guns, you know, are taken care of and put in prison. Menge was just one of a handful, a small minority of congressmen that voted against requiring mandatory sentencing for those that commit a crime with a gun during drug trafficking. I think that's an example of how we're really not being strong in our enforcement, and we really ought to focus on enforcing our existing gun laws.
I want to talk about the environment for just a minute. The presidential campaign has gotten interesting in the last day or so with a proposal from Governor Bush to open up certain wilderness areas to oil exploration. Do you have a general environmental philosophy, and where would that fall within that?
I believe in diversity. You know, the federal government owns a very large part of our country. There are opportunities within that significant amount of the land that's owned by the federal government to have totally pristine areas that we totally preserve and keep in wilderness. There's opportunities for many other things. And clearly there's part of that that may be able to be opened to oil exploration or other uses, whether it be recreational uses that involve more than just walking or not. And I think we ought to take not a black or white approach to this, but recognize that there's a diversity of interest, and there's a lot of land under federal control, and we ought to manage it to try to see if we can't deal with all of those interests and not just, you know, one exclusive part. I think, you know, those are my concerns. Another key area that that may affect is roads. I mean, I believe we ought to be having roads so that we're not stuck in traffic and away from our families. Another key difference between myself and my opponent, who voted against the last roads bill, I would have voted for it.
Is the abortion issue at play at all in the second district race so far?
I mean, the abortion issue, I am pro-life. You know, if my opponent has a somewhat different voting record, whether that's in play or not, I don't know.
And the defense, U.S. Defense Forces, in looking back over the last 8 years, has it been an appropriate use to send U.S. soldiers overseas to the manner that we have? Should it be beefed up, cut back? What do you think?
Well, first of all, I think that we're asking our troops to do more with less. And we ought to be focusing on American priorities and those that are in our strategic interests. And when we have things that are more European conflict, you need to have the leadership to get Europe to take more of a leadership role in those. And you also need to make sure that you're giving our GIs the resources they need to do the job and not be handcuffing them like we have in the past. When we have 12,000 GIs on food stamps and over 200,000 in substandard housing, we're not treating them in the way that they should be. And we need to make sure that our soldiers and men and women in fighting uniforms have the resources they need to defend us, and that we take care of our veterans. And I don't think in either case we're doing that.
You also have an emphasis on getting areas of Minnesota and rural America wired to the internet and seeing a certain high-tech initiative.
Absolutely. I mean, I see high-speed telecommunications, or the internet, is the way to bridge the geographic gap between the rural areas and job opportunities. And there are many ways of doing that, but we need to make sure that they stay connected. I helped Shopko stores keep all their stores connected with high-speed telecommunications, and I'm going to work very hard to make sure that our rural areas do that and they can connect to the job opportunities, because there are many types of employments where you don't have to be right in the metro area, but can do services, whether it be graphics, being a graphic artist, or being a stockbroker and coming into the cities 1 or 2 days a week, but otherwise living in the rural areas, because there's some beautiful areas out there, some home prices at very attractive prices, some great school districts, that I think if people had the chance, that they would live there rather than necessarily only really having the urban alternative.
In the new economy, should the government tax purchases and such that take place over the internet, or should that be kind of a free-for-all kind of area?
Well, right now we have a five-year moratorium, and that five-year moratorium is there, on one hand, to let the internet economy get off the ground and really flourish, but on the other hand, it's really almost impossible to think about how we could apply the existing sales tax system on a state-by-state, city-by-city, county-by-county sometimes basis on the internet without just bogging it down so it didn't work. We need to, during the period of time that we've already set aside for a moratorium, figure out how can we balance the interests of keeping that state revenue source so we don't have to push it somewhere else, or maybe we will end up having to push it somewhere else, but balance those issues with also and continuing to nurture the development of the internet, but also not penalizing bricks and mortar retailers. And I want to engage in that debate over the next several years so that by the time the existing moratorium comes up, we can have a better solution for it than we do now.
Before I let you go, let me just ask you a couple of questions about Mark Kennedy, the individual. What do you like to do when it's a nice day out your way? And what's your hobbies? What do you enjoy most?
Well, I live in God's country, and I live on 60 acres. I love the rural areas. I love the country. I love being out in the backyard. I have four wonderful children, so whether it's playing basketball with them or reading books with them, I also love educational vacation. Love going out to museums and historic sites. My children accuse me of being a walking history book. So spending time with my children and family, and I have three brothers, three sisters, parents, in-laws, and two brother-in-laws here in Minnesota that we also spend a lot of family time with, and those are the types of occasionally take in a movie with the family and occasionally rent a video with the family, and those are the types of things that I enjoy doing. I also enjoy very much campaigning. We've been at over 100 parades, 25 county fairs. My wife and I met in 4-H, so we feel very comfortable at a 4-H food stand. You know, those are the types of things that I really enjoy. I think I'm going to enjoy campaigning more, frankly, than I am going to be going to D.C. and representing the 2nd District, but I'm looking forward to doing that effectively for Southwest Minnesota.
There's some good museums in Washington.
There are some good museums, and I think history in particular is important in that, you know, whenever we forget history, we're destined to relive it, but museums can really help things like science and other things really come to life, and my wife and I haven't yet gotten our children to like art museums as much as we do, but hopefully that's something that will come with maturity.
What's your favorite museum, if you had to recommend only one?
If I had to recommend only one, that would be a tough one. I think one that's maybe overlooked is the Henry Ford Museum in Detroit. That's a museum of everyday life. Where they have all the old typewriters and washing machines and cars and everything. And when you think about the continual progress we make, you just never really think about, that's how it used to be, and here's how it evolved over time. So, you know, being a businessman, things like that really appeal to me.
What's your favorite movie of all time?
My favorite movie of all time. Now, we just watched Father of the Bride, the new version, with Mr. Martin, but Spencer Tracy and Elizabeth Taylor, that was a pretty good movie as well.